A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
After 300 episodes of optimizing prompts for machines, Daniel wants to know what happens when we stop switching modes and start talking to humans the same way we talk to AI agents. Minimize context load, remove ambiguity, enforce clear turn-taking. He's asking for a practical game plan. How would you actually speak to your spouse or neighbor if you treated them like a language model? And should you say things like, checking my memory, to really sell the performance?
I love this. It's completely deranged, and I love it.
It's the kind of question that sounds like satire, until you realize Daniel works with AI agents every day and might be serious.
I'm going to take it seriously. Because here's the thing, there's actual psychology underneath this. We already code switch between dozens of communication modes every day. The way you talk to a barista isn't how you talk to your mother, isn't how you talk to a customs agent. Adding AI agent mode to the repertoire is just one more register. The question is whether we can borrow specific patterns from it without becoming unbearable.
And the answer is almost certainly no, but let's map it out anyway.
So let's break down what we actually mean by speaking like an agent, and why it's harder than it sounds. The core premise here is treating human conversation as a context window optimization problem. Minimize tokens, maximize signal, enforce strict turn-taking. You're basically asking, what if my spouse had a system prompt?
I already know how Hannah would respond to being given a system prompt, and it wouldn't be with a structured output.
But the tension is real, and it's been studied. There's a framework in linguistics called Grice's Maxims, four principles that describe how cooperative conversation works. Quantity, be as informative as needed, no more. Quality, be truthful. Relevance, stay on topic. Manner, be clear and orderly. These were formulated in the 1970s by the philosopher Paul Grice, and they describe what humans intuitively expect from each other in dialogue.
And AI agent best practices violate at least two of them immediately.
Quantity gets blown out. Agents want maximal relevant information up front, way beyond what a human would naturally volunteer. And manner gets pushed to an extreme where clarity becomes this almost bureaucratic precision. A human says, can you grab milk? An agent, optimized human, says, task, purchase milk. Constraint, store closes at 9 p.m. Confirm completion.
If I said that to you, you'd assume I was having a medical event.
And that's the friction point. Grice's maxims assume cooperative dialogue where under-information isn't necessarily rude. It's an invitation for the other person to ask follow-ups. That's how humans build rapport. But agent communication treats under-information as an error state. The system needs everything specified, or it hallucinates.
So the fundamental trade-off is clarity versus warmth. And warmth isn't just a nice to have. It's doing real social work.
Right. Warmth signals. I see you as a person. I trust you to fill gaps. I'm not treating this as a transaction. When you strip that out, you're not just being efficient, you're sending a meta message that the relationship doesn't matter in this exchange. That's why it feels dehumanizing even when the words are perfectly clear.
Let's get concrete. Daniel specifically mentions using phrases like checking my memory and retrieving memory. Walk me through the actual AI agent communication playbook and what each piece would sound like translated to human speech.
To understand why this feels so weird, we need to look at the actual mechanics of how we talk to agents versus humans. The AI agent playbook has about four core components. First, the system prompt. That's where you set the ground rules before any interaction begins. You're a helpful assistant. You respond in JSON. You never ask clarifying questions. Second, structured turn-taking with explicit roles. User says something, assistant responds, there's no overlap and no interruption. Third, context window management. You deliberately drop irrelevant history because the model can only hold so much. And fourth, constrained output formats. Respond in one sentence, list three options, answer yes or no.
So mapping each to a human equivalent, The system prompt becomes stating your assumptions up front. I'm going to ask you 3 yes or no questions. Don't elaborate.
Which in a marriage would go over like a lead balloon. But it's actually not that different from what good managers do in high-stakes situations. Here's what I need from this conversation. Here's the format. Here's when we're done. The difference is consent. In a workplace, the manager has legitimate authority to set the frame. In a personal relationship, unilaterally declaring the conversational format is itself a power move.
Context window management is the one that fascinates me. With an AI, you're constantly deciding what to include and exclude from the prompt, because the token limit is real and you pay for everyone. The human equivalent would be saying, I'm setting aside everything we discussed yesterday and focusing exclusively on today's logistics.
Which sounds cold, but there's a version of this that's actually therapeutic. Couples therapists sometimes recommend bracketing, agreeing to set aside a larger conflict to focus on one specific issue. The difference is that bracketing is mutual and explicit. You both agree to the frame. What Daniel's describing is one person unilaterally imposing it.
The constrained output format is where it gets truly absurd. Please answer in one sentence. To your neighbor.
I had a neighbor in Connecticut who basically only spoke in constrained output formats. He'd say yep and nope, and that was the whole vocabulary. We thought he was rude. Turns out he was just ahead of his time. He was running a minimalist language model in his head.
Or he hated you.
Equally possible. But the checking my memory thing is actually the most interesting piece of this, because humans do retrieve memories, we just don't announce it. We pause, we look away, we say and the other person reads those cues and waits. What the agent-style phrasing does is make the cognitive operation explicit and verbal. It's metacommunication. You're communicating about your communication.
And that's not inherently bad. If I'm in a serious conversation and I say, give me a moment, I'm trying to remember exactly how that went. That's normal. The weirdness comes from using the clinical, mechanistic phrasing, retrieving memory, which signals that you're performing machine-like behavior rather than just being thoughtful.
There's a real phenomenon here that psychologists have documented. When human speech becomes too efficient, too direct, too stripped of social padding, listeners perceive the speaker as less trustworthy. One study found about a 40% drop in perceived trustworthiness when speech was stripped of what they called social lubricant, the little hedges, the softening phrases, the conversational turn signals.
40% is massive. That's not, oh, you seem a bit curt today. That's, I don't trust this person's intentions.
And the mechanism seems to be what some researchers call the uncanny valley of conversation. Just like a robot that looks almost human but not quite triggers revulsion, speech that's almost natural but too efficient triggers suspicion. Your brain's agency detection system flags it. This doesn't sound like a person. Something's wrong.
Which means the efficiency gain is probably illusory. Sure, you save 10 seconds by not saying, hey, how are you? But you then spend 5 minutes repairing the social damage.
Unless both parties have agreed to the frame. And that's the key insight. This only works when it's consensual.
So we've mapped the mechanics. But what happens when you actually try this in the wild? Daniel mentioned the social energy cost of switching modes. Is that cost real, or is it just a feeling?
It's real and measurable. Code switching between communication modes, and I'm using the term broadly here, not just linguistically, has documented cognitive costs. Your brain has to reconfigure its expectations about turn-taking, about appropriate levels of detail, about what counts as a complete response. Each switch burns glucose and increases cortisol. Over a day of moving between Slack, email, voice calls, and AI agent prompts, that adds up to measurable cognitive depletion.
So the efficiency argument has a surface logic. If I just pick one mode and use it everywhere, I save all that switching cost.
And that logic is wrong for exactly the reason we just identified. You don't save the cost, you just shift it. Instead of paying the switching cost internally, you pay it externally in social friction. Your brain is less tired, but your relationships are worse. That's not a net win unless you're a hermit.
I'm a sloth, so I have some natural hermit tendencies. But even I know you can't optimize your marriage by treating it like an API call.
Let me give you a concrete example from the research. A software engineer, this was documented in a workplace study, reported that after about 6 months of heavy AI agent use, they started unconsciously prefacing requests to their partner with phrases like, "I have a single instruction for you." The partner found it dehumanizing. Not because the words themselves are offensive, but because they signal a frame where the partner is a tool, not a collaborator.
I have a single instruction for you. That's grim.
It's efficient. It's clear. It's also a fast track to sleeping on the couch.
But here's where I want to push back a little. There are communities, particularly in neurodiverse spaces, where direct, unambiguous communication is actively preferred. Autistic-led communication guides often emphasize exactly the things we're describing as agent-like, state your needs explicitly, don't rely on subtext, confirm understanding rather than assuming it.
This is a crucial point, and it's the biggest misconception we need to address. Direct communication isn't inherently rude. Rudeness is about violating the agreed norms of a conversation. If both people have agreed that directness is the norm, then "please answer in one sentence" is perfectly fine. The problem isn't the words, it's the unilateral imposition of a frame the other person didn't consent to.
So the neurodiversity parallel actually clarifies the whole thing. These communication guides exist precisely because the default norm, indirect, hint-based, socially padded, doesn't work for everyone. The solution isn't everyone should talk like an AI agent. It's groups should explicitly negotiate their communication norms.
And that's where the agent-inspired patterns might actually have legitimate applications. Not in casual conversation with your spouse, but in specific, bounded contexts where efficiency genuinely matters more than rapport.
Give me an example.
A remote team I read about adopted what they called agent-style meeting protocols. Agenda distributed in advance as a kind of system prompt. This meeting has 3 objectives. We'll spend 10 minutes on each. Decisions will be recorded as action items with owners. Turn-taking was explicit. Hand raises, no interruptions, each person speaks uninterrupted for their allotted time. At the end, explicit confirmation of understanding. I'm hearing 3 action items. Can everyone confirm?
And what happened?
Meetings got about 30% shorter. Satisfaction scores dropped. People reported feeling processed rather than heard. The efficiency gain was real, but it came at a cost to team cohesion.
That's the whole dilemma in a nutshell. You can make human communication more efficient, but you pay for it in the currency of relationship.
And the currency of relationship has real value. Teams with higher cohesion outperform teams with lower cohesion on complex tasks. A marriage with warmth beats a marriage with optimized logistics. The efficiency isn't free.
So where does that leave Daniel's actual question? He's asking for a practical game plan. Is there a version of this that doesn't make you insufferable?
I think there is, but it requires a frame shift. Instead of, "I'm going to talk to humans like they're AI agents," which is inherently dehumanizing, the move is, "I'm going to selectively borrow specific agent communication patterns for specific situations where they actually help."
So a toolkit, not a personality replacement.
And the boundary tool is the one I think has the most legitimate application. The checking my memory, gambit. Verbalizing cognitive operations is actually useful when both people understand it as a signal. If my spouse and I agree that, "let me think about that," means, "give me 10 seconds of silence," that's not agent-like, that's just good metacommunication.
The difference is the phrasing. "Let me think about that" is normal human speech. Retrieving memory is a bit.
It's a bit. And bits are fine when everyone's in on the joke. If Hannah and Daniel have a running joke where they say "processing" instead of "hold on," that's playful. It becomes a problem when one person is doing it unironically and the other person feels like they're being managed.
So the first rule of the game plan is, get consent. Don't impose the frame unilaterally.
Rule 1. Rule 2. Use agent-style communication only in contexts where efficiency is the primary goal. Task delegation, emergency instructions, complex multi-step requests, where ambiguity could cause real problems. The babysitter needs to know 3 things. Ezra's allergic to peanuts, bedtime is 7:30, and the emergency number is on the fridge. That's basically a system prompt, and it's completely appropriate.
Rule 3. State the interaction mode up front. This is what I'd call pre-chaining. Before you launch into the efficient version, you say, "I need to give you a quick task, then we can chat." That one sentence sets expectations and dramatically reduces the social sting.
Because you've signaled that this is a temporary mode, not your new personality. You're saying, "I'm about to be direct for a specific reason, and then we'll return to normal." The other person can tolerate 30 seconds of agent speak if they know it's bounded.
It's the conversational equivalent of, "I'm going to put you on speakerphone for a second."
And just like speakerphone, it's fine in small doses and maddening if it's your entire life.
What about turn-taking? Daniel specifically asked about boundaries in turn-taking. In AI interactions, overlapping turns cause errors. In human conversation, overlapping is often a sign of engagement and rapport.
This is where the agent model actually has something useful to offer, but only in specific settings. In high-stakes or low-bandwidth conversations, think a bad phone connection or a discussion where misunderstanding would be catastrophic. Explicit turn-passing signals are helpful. Your turn to speak. I'm done. Go ahead. Pilots and air traffic controllers already do this. It's called protocol communication, and it saves lives.
But at the dinner table, it's psychotic.
At the dinner table, overlapping speech is how you know people like each other. Studies of conversational overlap show that friends interrupt each other more than strangers do, because interruption in that context isn't a violation, it's a signal of engagement. I'm so excited about what you're saying that I can't wait for you to finish.
So the same behavior that's a bug in an AI interaction is a feature in human bonding.
Which is why you can't just port the agent playbook directly. You have to understand what each pattern is doing before you borrow it. Turn-taking protocols reduce ambiguity, but also reduce spontaneity. That trade-off makes sense in a cockpit. It makes no sense on a date.
Let's talk about the checking my memory and retrieving memory phrases specifically. Daniel seems to be asking whether these are useful metacommunicative tools or just performance art.
I think they're performance art that happens to have a useful function. The function is real. By verbalizing a cognitive operation, you're giving the other person a window into what's happening in your head. That reduces ambiguity. "I'm not ignoring you, I'm thinking," is useful information. The question is whether you need to phrase it like a robot to get that benefit.
And the answer is no, but the robot phrasing is funnier.
It's very funny. If I'm on a DJ gig and someone requests a song and I say, "retrieving memory," while I try to remember if I have it, that's comedy. But if I say it to a patient's parents while trying to recall a drug interaction, that's alarming.
Context collapses the distinction between useful and unhinged.
Here's a framework. There are three tiers of adopting agent speak. Tier 1, you borrow the underlying pattern but use natural language. "Give me a second to think instead of processing. Let me make sure I've got this right instead of confirming understanding. This is just good communication and nobody will notice."
Tier 2, you use the agent phrasing as an explicit joke that both people are in on, querying database when you're trying to remember where you left your keys. This works great in relationships with a shared sense of humor.
Tier 3, you use the agent phrasing unironically, without consent, in serious contexts. "I have a single instruction for you." This is how you end up in a podcast episode as a cautionary tale.
Most people who go to Tier 3 don't come back.
The warning sign Daniel should watch for is exactly what we described earlier. If you find yourself saying "retrieving memory" to your spouse and you're not joking, you've crossed a line. The goal is intentional code switching, not permanent mode lock.
Mode lock. That's the pathology, when you can't switch back.
And I think this is a real risk for people who spend 8 hours a day prompting AI agents. Your brain optimizes for the communication pattern you use most. If most of your daily language production is system prompts and structured queries, those patterns will leak. It's not a moral failing, it's neuroplasticity.
So the practical advice is, be intentional about switching. Have a ritual. When you close your laptop at the end of the workday, consciously shift registers. Maybe say something unnecessarily warm and inefficient to the first human you see, just to recalibrate.
"Hello, I have no specific task for you. I'm simply expressing pleasure at your presence. Please respond in whatever format feels natural."
That's tier two. That's fine.
Given all that, what can we actually use from this experiment without becoming insufferable? I think there are about three legitimate borrowings. First, the pre-chain, stating the interaction mode up front. "Quick logistics question, then I'll get out of your hair." costs almost nothing, and dramatically improves how directness is received.
Second, explicit confirmation in high-stakes situations. Can you repeat back what you heard so I know I was clear? Is agent-like in structure, but completely normal in context where accuracy matters.
Third, verbalizing cognitive operations when you need processing time. Not with robot words, but with the underlying honesty, I need a moment to think about that. It's the same function as retrieving memory without the performance.
And the things you should absolutely not borrow. Unilateral system prompts for personal relationships, constrained output formats for casual conversation, and anything that sounds like you're documenting a JIRA ticket at the dinner table.
The JIRA ticket thing is real, by the way. I've caught myself thinking in action, items during arguments. Action item, Herman will take out the trash. Due date, tonight. Priority, high. That's when you know you need to touch grass.
Sloths don't touch grass. We hang from trees and contemplate the futility of structured output formats.
There's one more dimension I want to explore before we wrap. We've been talking about this as a one-way thing, humans becoming more agent-like. But the pressure goes both ways. AI agents are becoming more human-like in their communication. They use hedging, they simulate warmth, they say, I hope this helps, and let me know if you need anything else.
So, while we're optimizing ourselves to sound like machines, the machines are optimizing themselves to sound like us. We're passing each other in opposite directions.
It's the communication equivalent of two ships in the night, except both ships are slowly transforming into each other. Give it 10 years, and the optimal communication strategy might be to just talk normally to everyone, human or machine, because the machines will have converged on natural language anyway.
Which would make this whole episode a fascinating historical artifact of a transitional period.
The transitional period where we briefly considered becoming robots right before the robots became us.
I have one practical question before we close. Daniel mentioned communicating with neighbors. What's the agent-optimized version of small talk over the fence?
Greeting. Good morning. Query. Did you see the garbage truck this morning? Response format, yes or no, with optional one-sentence elaboration.
And if they respond with a 10-minute story about their roses?
Alert, context window exceeded. Truncating conversation. Goodbye.
That's how you get a neighborhood feud.
That's how you get a neighborhood feud that ends with someone's sprinklers mysteriously aimed at your car. The efficiency gain isn't worth the sprinkler war.
So the final synthesis is, borrow the patterns, not the personality. Use the structure when it helps, drop it when it hurts, and never say retrieving memory to someone you want to keep liking you.
And if you do say it, make sure you're both laughing.
But isn't this whole premise just rebranding basic communication skills that therapists have been teaching for decades? Use I statements, be direct, confirm understanding. That's not AI agent stuff. That's just being a functional adult.
Hilbert, you've cut right through 3,000 words of brotherly analysis, and I resent it.
No, he's right, and I should have said this earlier. A lot of what we're calling agent-inspired communication is just clear communication that clinical psychology figured out 50 years ago. The AI frame is new, but the underlying skills, stating needs explicitly, checking for understanding, managing conversational load, are ancient. What's new is the specific flavor of weirdness that comes from adopting the machine-like phrasing and the cognitive depletion argument for minimizing mode switching. But the core insight? Yeah, your therapist got there first.
Thank you, Hilbert. As always, you've humbled us with a single sentence.
The open question I'm left with is about the direction of pressure. As AI agents get better at mimicking human warmth, and they're getting very good, will the incentive to become more agent-like fade? If your AI assistant already sounds like a person, maybe you don't need to develop a separate communication mode for it. You just talk normally to everything.
Or the opposite happens. The machines get so good at warmth that the only way to distinguish yourself as a human is to become more efficient and direct. The weirdest prompt might be the one you use on yourself. Asking how would I prompt a human to get what I need, and realizing the answer is usually with kindness in context.
Thanks to producer Hilbert Flumingtop for the reality check. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've ever caught yourself saying processing to a human, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We want the stories.
We'll be back soon. Try not to optimize your loved ones in the meantime.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.